Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome back to The Wonder, science-based paganism. I'm your host, Mark.
And I'm Yucca.
And today we're going to talk about rites of passage. There are milestones in life that are worth marking. They're worth taking a moment to ceremonially observe that a change has happened in someone's life and to acknowledge that and to have the community see it. And that's what a rite of passage is all about. We're going to talk about a number of different kinds of rites of passage today, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah.
So where would you like to start, Yucca?
Well, why don't we start with maybe briefly the places that our culture does have rites of passage.
Okay.
Right, just some example. Before we started recording, we mentioned the high school graduation as being somewhat of a stand-in for moving in adulthood, weddings.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and not everyone, but many people do have a naming ceremony or a christening ceremony for their child. I know particularly that Catholics do that. I'm not so sure about the various Protestant varieties because I never was Christian, but I believe that some of them have various naming ceremonies as well.
I think some of that gets kind of wrapped into the baby shower, or kind of a first birthday party is a really big deal for a lot of families.
Of course.
Even if the kid has a name, often they'll have a name before that point, but in terms of celebrations for the child when they're young, birthdays later on. But I think the baby shower and first birthday.
What strikes me when I think about the rites of passage that exist in our overculture right now, though, is that all of them are kind of implicit rites of passage, with the possible exception of weddings. Rather than coming straight out and saying, we, the community, welcome you, baby, your name will be this, and we all wish you well, there's this sort of, well, everybody has to bring a present sort of thing. And it's ceremonial, but it's not explicitly doing what it's functionally doing for the parents. Because, of course, the baby, it doesn't make any difference to. The baby is just absorbing information as fast as it can and trying to figure out what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. And eating too much sugar.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, that's the only thing they can taste when they're born. The only taste buds that are active are the sugar taste buds.
I haven't heard that. Okay.
Yeah. That's why breast milk is so sweet. Like, oh yeah, good. Terrific. Great. Sugar, sugar, sugar. Sugar's good for me. I like sugar.
ones that are missing on cats, by the way. I suspect probably many other obligate carnivores as well just simply don't have them.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense because they don't eat. I mean, they wouldn't eat fruit.
Yeah.
Or honey. But I bet they have a lot of umami taste buds.
Mm.
Yep. Meat. Meat. Meat good.
Marrow.
Yeah. So... All right, we've already had our first tangent of the podcast. the ways that we live an intentional life are nested like Russian dolls to me. There is the personal intentional life that we live, and then there's the intentional life that we live with our family. But there are further rings out from that, where there are communities that we want to recognize that something has happened, something has changed. And it's the thing about a rite of passage is that in almost all cases, they are changes that are viewed as being permanent. In a naming ceremony, here's your name. This is it. Welcome to the community. We're only going to welcome you once. Here's your name.
Yeah.
In welcoming someone to adulthood, it's okay. You have responsibilities now. You have additional rights, but you also have responsibilities. And here's how we are going to expect you to act now. Congratulations on your empowerment as an adult. In the case of, even in the case of a wedding, most of the languaging that we do around that is it's permanent, it's forever, even though we know that 50% of the time that isn't true.
Mm-hmm. The goal in most cases is, even if it doesn't end up working that way. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, rites of passage are things that we do because they are, they're important milestones in our lives. They're moments that we don't want to experience alone. We want people to see them. And we want to be acknowledged for them. And there are a number of those milestones that our culture does not acknowledge at all that I think are important. Mm-hmm. I think they're important for us to recognize. So maybe we should start talking about what some of those are.
Sure. Yeah, well, how should we do this? Should we start with some of the ones that we think are missing, or should we maybe start at going through the human lifespan?
Why don't we go through the human life cycle, starting before birth?
Okay. Well, before birth, well, we already mentioned the baby shower, but my personal take on that is that that's really more about the parent in a lot of ways. And I know some people do all of these like gender reveals and showers and, but the way we approached it, so I have two children. We did a baby shower for the first and not the second. The second came pretty close after the first anyways, but it really was more about, hey, welcome to this parenthood thing. From here on out, for the next 20 years, you shall no longer be known by your name, but your child, you're going to now be your child named mom. In a joking way, but also in a serious way of just get used to your identity is going to be changing, and some of your roles as a, your roles in society is going to change in the way that you think about yourself and feel about yourself, and in a way that you know that it's going to be big, but bigger than you could have ever imagined.
Right. And I think that is another aspect of true rites of passage, those true milestones, is that as big a leap as they are, as you acknowledge them to be, you will discover in living them that they are even more big, complex, transformative than you imagined. Yes.
Yeah.
So yes, even before birth, there is an opportunity to create a rite of passage for parents, mm-hmm, in order to welcome them into that parenthood role. And we were talking before we started recording, and one of the things that I mentioned is that that doesn't necessarily have to involve a pregnancy.
Yep.
Because when people are adopting, you know, they may know, wow, 3 weeks from now, our child is coming. And that is a perfect time for a community acknowledgement of welcome to parenthood. Here's a little wisdom that I learned from my experience with parenthood. Here are some, you know, tokens and gifts to help you on your way. We wish you well, but you're parents now, and we're acknowledging that as a community. So I think that would be a great thing.
Yeah. Well, and I would love to see it be not just for motherhood. Right.
Yes.
Like parenthood in general, but even if somebody's going through they are doing it through a pregnancy, and that's how the family is being, mm-hmm, grown. That all of the parent, both, all, whatever the situation is, that for everybody involved, that recognition, whatever names you're calling it by.
Yes, this ties in with the whole overculture view of masculinity, which is another big topic that we could talk about for a long time. But I mean, basically, this is less true than it used to be. It's far less true than it used to be. But still, there is this sense that the mother is the real parent and the father is just sort of a helpmate.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea of an equal partnership and equal responsibility in child rearing really still doesn't, that's not what we see as the subtext. We see the same thing in marriages. I mean, this is changing also, but like you have an impending marriage and, you know, the guy is supposed to run off with his guy friends and do all this sort of mad stuff that he won't be allowed to once he's married. It's all very odd, if you ask me.
Yeah.
So yes, I agree that when people are going to be parents, all the people that are going to be parents need to be involved in that celebration
and honored for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because it's not for the faint of heart. it's a big job. And it's the kind of big job where at some level, at some point, probably when your kids are teenagers, you have to come to grips with the fact that you're going to do some things wrong that they're going to have lasting resentments about. And there's probably nothing you can do about that.
For me, that realization has come many years before teenagehood.
Okay, well.
But maybe I just haven't gotten quite to that level of the degree to which yet. But I think that's a big part of parenthood.
I think so, too. Yeah.
Doing your best, but knowing that we're human.
Yep. We're human. We're human and we produce more humans. And that's the game. Mm-hmm. So that's what can be done before parenthood. And there are various traditions that lead in that direction. But my inclination is, I don't know. I mean, I've been to baby showers where, you know, both men and women were invited and it all seemed very dissociative to me. It was a lot of pastel colors and sort of strange, fluffy strangeness. And
there's some interesting, there's for me personally, there were a lot of traditions that I went, no, that's uncomfortable and weird. No wrapping me in toilet paper. This is what?
Oh my God. Yeah.
But you know, for some people it's a really fun, joyous thing. So I certainly do not want to put any, you know, I don't want to judge anyone else for what works for them with that. But I think it's really an opportunity to look at the symbols that matter to you and what they mean to you and your community, right? Yes. Recognizing that your community, some of the members are, well, we're all products of our larger culture and there may be meaningful elements for some, you know, it's interesting designing a ritual for a group.
Yes.
And balancing those needs.
Right. One thing that I've seen and I've done actually with a naming ceremony for an infant was we gave gifts to the parents to give to the child when they were 12, 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pagan things. They were things like tarot decks and symbols and things like that that came from the community, but which were intended not to be playthings for them in their infancy, but to be introduced to them as they came along into teenhood and adulthood so that they would be familiar with them and they could play around with them and make them their own.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. I thought that was a pretty cool thing.
Yeah. Well, that leads to the next naming ceremonies.
Yes, which is kind of all encapsulated in the name, in the title, right?
Oh, yeah.
Hello, welcome to the world. Here's your name. Carry on. But once again, that's really more for the parents. Mm-hmm. It's an acknowledgement of, okay. And I have to say that in this case, unless it's an adoption, I would focus this more on the mother, because the mother has been through this ordeal. The mother has gone through this really intense physical experience. And I would incorporate some acknowledgement of that in the gathering together and the offering to the community of this child that we have named Norman, or mm-hmm. whatever we've named the child. I always come up with sort of weird, nerdy names when I have to pick one out of the air.
Well, some people also, I've seen this be sort of the first birthday for people who haven't done I know for us personally, this was something we chose not to do, because the whole time period of the infancy is such a, at least for me, I experienced it. It's this very intimate, very, very vulnerable time period. Not vulnerable in like a scary way, but just, you know, that having gone through such an intense ordeal of birth and the whole process of getting there, and then having this new tiny little person, you know, for us, it didn't feel I didn't want a lot of visitors. I didn't want it to be a kind of a showing off sort of thing. And again, I think these types of passages, you can do them in many different ways, but the naming ceremonies that I have been to, which have actually all, I haven't been to a pagan one. I've been to ones that were Jewish. They just felt like such a huge, big ordeal. And it was, to me, it was just very overwhelming. So it was something we chose to not do. Although I did write letters and poems to my children about their names that we'll give to them later on in life.
That's a nice tradition. I like that.
Right, because we were very intentional on what their names were. Mm-hmm. So I suppose I'm saying that I think that these are very useful, but that it may not fit in every situation or every family. It might not be what they want to do. And that's okay, right? You know, we're not like recording this to say, now you need to...
You need rites of passage. You need lots of them, and you need to get started on them right now because you're behind. You should have been doing this from before your kids were born.
Yeah.
No, sorry. We're just not that prescriptive.
Yeah. So anyways, I think that the first birthday has often filled that kind of role for people who don't come from a background that has a more formal naming mm-hmm. ceremony.
There are cultures, I want to say in Africa, but I'm not 100% sure, that don't give a name to a child until it's a year old.
That's my understanding with some of the Pueblos in this area.
Oh, really? As well? Okay. Yeah. Maybe I've got my ethnographies mixed up. It's been a long time since I took anthropology.
Well, I suspect that sounds like a pretty common... That sounds to me like a lot of people might do that.
Yeah, because of infant mortality.
Yeah.
And in our situation, in the modern world, because of medical technology, that is so much less of an issue that it would be less wrenching to give a name to a child, because they're so much more likely to survive.
I think that's an element, but I also think that sometimes they just don't fit the name that just out of respect for their privacy, I'm not going to share my own children's names, but with my oldest, the name that we gave her is a shortened version of a long traditional name. And we decided it's a long Russian name. We're not Russian, but there's a whole story behind all of that. But we chose to give her the shortened version of the name. But when we met her on the outside, right? Like, I had a relationship with her for months at that point. But she was clearly that other name. And so we call her it's that name now, the more traditional name, even though it's not her legal name. We call her both. We call her a million different names, but it just, we met her and that's what it was. And I've heard that story from a lot of parents before. So that's, I think, an element is that sometimes people clearly aren't the name that you had picked out.
Right. And after a year, a personality is discernible. There are many things about a child that you will know after a year's time.
Yeah.
So you're much more likely to guess right after a year than you are just.
Yeah. I mean, there's certain things you get from the very, you know, I notice personality things about my kids from in the womb.
Hmm.
In terms of how kicky certain ones were or weren't, or how much they cooperated with ultrasounds or didn't cooperate. but a lot of the personality stuff you learn later on when you meet them as a separate person instead of like a somebody in you. That's different.
Sure, sure. Yeah. My sister-in-law, when she was pregnant, she had an amniocentesis. And my niece grabbed the needle. Wouldn't let go for a long time. And of course, their flesh is so pulpy at that point, you can't withdraw the needle because it'll do real damage.
Yeah.
So we had to sit there until she got bored and let go of the needle. And then they could come out.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's so much personality that is already starting to develop. That's why I don't believe in the blank slate. It's clearly not.
Oh, clearly not. No. It's just nature and nurture for sure.
Yeah, there's a big mix of them. So that's another tangent. There we go. What are we at? Three?
Yeah. Two? Let me see. So next is adulthood, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I should also say at this point that we are talking about the rites of passage. We're not trying to give instructions about how to do rites of passage. There is some of that on the atheopaganism.org website. If you click, there's a tag cloud in the right-hand column. If you click rites of passage, it'll take you to all of the posts that have been flagged, that have been tagged with that tag. But we might go into more detail in the future about how specifically to do a particular ceremony, like a parenthood ceremony or a naming ceremony or a rite of passage into adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
The rite of passage into adulthood is a challenge because adulthood is a moving target.
Yeah.
And we know that sexual maturity lags brain maturity by nearly 10 years, sometimes in excess of 10 years. And that leads to all kinds of problematic situations. My personal take has always been that there should be stepping stones towards the passage into adulthood. And then at 18, you do the passage into adulthood, which is, okay, you know, we give you the franchise of the vote. We give you, you know, your liberty to go and do as you please. You're an adult and you can make choices now for yourself when you couldn't before. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I really like the idea of the stepping stone because I do think that there's something coming from the female perspective, your first period, I think that that's so important for that recognition. And yet, clearly, for the vast majority of people, when you're getting your first period, you're nowhere, you're not an adult.
You're not an adult. No.
But it is so, so it's like it's almost two different things there.
I'm just thinking about this now. It would be possible to do a passage into young adulthood as someone arrives in their teen years and then say, okay, you've done the apprenticeship for adulthood. Now you now you get the full credential at 18.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't have any problem with that. I think, you know, if the child wants to do it is really the issue for me. I mean, I've in extended and chosen family, I have experience of girls who wanted nothing to do with a first period ceremony. They were just, it was embarrassing and they didn't want it and they just wanted to be left alone.
Yeah.
And they were well into the teen, not in years, but they were definitely in teenage mode at that point. Like, oh, yeah. Leave me alone. It's my own business. Go away.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, you know, it's not something you want to foist onto the subject of the ceremony.
Mm-hmm. Well, coming back though to, you know, I have grew up with a lot of Jewish friends with the bar and bat mitzvahs. Those were around the same time frame in life, but were certainly not tied. You know, you don't have to get your period to get your bat mitzvah.
Right, but a lot of that is because the bat mitzvah didn't used to be a thing. That it was only the bar mitzvah that was celebrated.
Yeah.
And so there isn't that incredibly meticulous, rationalized argument for why there has to be a bat mitzvah at this particular time that you would generally get in Jewish theology, right? Mm-hmm. There would be a volume of analysis by prominent rabbis about why the bat mitzvah should be at this particular junction in a child's life. That's something that I've always just found really amazing about Jewish culture. It's like, we're going to reason this to death, and there are going to be so many volumes.
Yeah, well, the older and longer a tradition's been around, the more opportunity there is for that kind of stuff. But
yes.
But yeah, I mean, coming back around, I think it's an interesting, the adulthood question. It's just such an interesting one right now, and it's going to be different for each family. Like you said, knowing some folks who just are not interested in that. And then it's easier to define for a female when that period would be, but I think it's equally important for someone who is male or someone who isn't identifying in either of those sides.
Right, right. You know, to be honest, as I so often am, you could do that with males too. The first ejaculation is really the first expression of actual sexual maturity. The problem is they're never going to admit it.
That was my next question. How do you know? It's a little easier to tell with a period.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But in theory, all things being equal, you could actually identify these sort of snapshot moments and say, okay, you're a teenager now. Here's what that means. You know, mm-hmm. Here's the support that the community is going to offer you. Here's the advice that the community is going to offer you, which you're going to ignore. Carry on. And we'll see you in 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. And we'll talk about making you a full-fledged adult. I could definitely see that happening.
Yeah.
And that's probably all we can say about that. I mean, there are some significant things that happen during that time. For many Americans, getting a driver's license and being able to drive a car is something that happens during that period. Mm-hmm. It's a period when there is a tremendous incidence of rash, ill-thought behavior that can impact people's lives for the rest of their lives or just simply end them. Mm-hmm. And I think that some sort of intercession at the beginning of the teen years, the more I think about this, the more this makes sense. Some sort of intercession at the beginning of the teen years with a warning at least.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be thinking about long-term results. You're going to want to go along and do what all of your friends are doing. You're going to want to feel like an adult. Don't drive 100 miles an hour. Don't get pregnant. Don't do all any of those things that feel like being an adult. Just please don't do them. Stay safe, and we're going to talk about you being an adult in a few years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could really see that. I wish somebody had done that for me. I did really stupid things when I was in my teens. Ah.
Well, moving along, and not that everyone is going to do this one, but I think weddings would be our next kind of rite of passage.
Yes, and they don't necessarily have to be legal weddings. They can be community acknowledgments of relationships. I mean, I know a lot of people that have lived together for decades, and there's never been a moment when their whole community came together and said, good on you. You get along. That's great. We think you're wonderful. Keep getting along. We're happy about that. It's such a joyous occasion, and it doesn't have to be one that is, you know, grown out of a very recent relationship, which I think is what our cultural assumption is about weddings.
Mm-hmm.
That these are people that will have only known one another for perhaps as much as a few years, and then they're committing to one another forever. It can also be people that have already been together for a long, long time and are just rolling out to the community and saying, we're pretty sure now. we think this is a good match. So we want the whole community to acknowledge that.
We were together for 5 years before we decided to do a ceremony and all of that. And then we're actually coming up on our 5th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
So, but for some folks, that's a very short period of time to have known and lived together for 5 years before getting married. And for others, that's a pretty long time.
Absolutely. It's all very individual. You know, clearly you're comfortable with your choice and you have kids and you feel supported and all that's good. So good.
Yep.
Definitely an opportunity to have a party and bring in the people that you care about most and have them see you being happy and acknowledging that this other person has come into your life who is precious to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And likewise for him and his loved ones to come in and do that. So, yeah, I mean, this is one of the rites of passage that our mainstream culture really acknowledges as being real. For one, because it has a legal component, if you choose to go that route, which has tax implications and, you know.
In all honesty, that was a big part for us is like, ooh, this math makes a lot more sense than the way we've been doing it.
You bet. You bet. Yep. I mean, Maya and I lived together for quite a while, and I realized we'd lost about $10,000 just because we weren't married.
Just because of the way the filing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think that's the way the tax code should be structured, but that's an entirely different conversation.
Yep.
I mean, when we got married, it was because we got married because we'd already had two marriage ceremonies. We had a hand fasting for a year and a day, and then we had a for the foreseeable future wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we gathered all our people together and stuff. And it was only a few years later that we went to the courthouse and pulled a marriage license.
Yeah.
And that wasn't a ceremonial thing at all. It was strictly a legal thing.
Well, I think we've mentioned it on here before, but personally, I think that those two things should not be what we do with the state, with the legal and the tax. That's a separate thing than the marriage.
Yeah, the idea of the state sanctifying relationships is really kind of gross. Did you hear, by the way, tangent warning,
mm-hmm.
Somerville, Massachusetts just approved a domestic partnership law that allows more than two domestic partners to register.
Wow, no, I didn't hear about that.
Yeah. And particularly there were city council members who said, look, I'm aware of at least 20 couples in this community, 20 families in this community that are living as various configurations of polyamory, and we need them to have access to health care because of the COVID virus.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really kind of the impetus for the thing, but it's the first time in the country that that's ever been acknowledged, wow. Which is really pretty remarkable. And it, once again, it goes to the state acknowledging particular kinds of relationships. I'd rather they got out of that business entirely, but if
they're gonna going to be there, they need to be
expansive equal, in their definition of what constitutes a family. Absolutely. So, marriages.
Well, and actually saying the family, that brings, we kind of touched on this with the parenthood, but families that are coming together in a different way, maybe the adoption of older children.
Yes.
Right. Or the joining together of various households, or so the joining together. So not just wedding in our traditional conventional sense of the man and the woman, but the coming together of peoples.
Yes. The formation of family.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because family is how we're built to roll. The small contained units that most of the time have children, they reproduce and, carry on. But family units, I mean, they can include previous generations. They can include others, uncles and aunts and, people who come in from outside and all that. However you define a family, that's a very sacred unit. We evolved in order to create these kind of small pods that we operate in. And recognizing that one of those has formed is a definite opportunity for a rite of passage.
Yeah.
And then there are when pods fall apart. And dissolution ceremonies, while much, much rarer than weddings, do exist. And I have been at a couple of them that where the people who were splitting up were doing it mostly amicably. I mean, there were
probably some tensions, I would imagine.
There were definitely tensions at times during the ceremony, but part of that is because what both of those participants were wanting to get out of it was a sense of freedom, of being liberated. And the tension was, I still feel bound to you. So what are we going to do in order to separate that so that I don't have to be connected to you anymore?
Mm-hmm.
And there are ritual things that you can do in order to make that separation happen. And so that people are free to go on their way and not, spend the next 3 years buried in resentment over how they were treated in a previous relationship, but rather move on with their lives.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very healthy thing to do if a relationship or a family situation is not working, not working because somebody's mad about dropping a carton of eggs, but not working. It's really
the personalities just are not,
fundamentally not working. Not serving and nourishing the people that are involved, then I think the right thing to do is to break that up. And a ceremonial observance of that can be incredibly cathartic.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of people that won't, where there's so much acrimony that they won't even get together in the same room to do a ceremony, you can still do stuff. I know people who've buried their wedding rings. and then gone through some sort of gesture of rebirth, you know, plunging into a cold pool in a stream or something like that and coming back out in order to represent that they're now washed clean of all of that stuff and they can go forward into the rest of their lives.
That's certainly something that I have didn't have a previous marriage, but leaving relationships, a particular very negative one that at least ended quite negatively, and that was incredibly liberating to just do a ceremony. For me, it was private, but I could imagine for someone who was, sometimes when you are in a, when you're a couple or a family, you end up with a whole community around you that they also are releasing that relationship.
Yes. And they are also, if things work out in a civil manner, you're doing your community a great favor by doing this, because many of them will feel that they're obligated to choose sides. And by doing this together, you can say to your community, you don't have to pick sides. You can be friends with both of us.
We're not a unit anymore. Yeah,
we're not a unit anymore. I don't necessarily need to hear about your adventures with my former partner, but we're not going to make you split just because we split. And that, I think, is a really powerful gift to give to the community of people around you.
Yeah.
So you get married, however many of you there are, and however you do that.
Yeah, if you do. And
if you do. And nobody says you have to. And then you live and you live and you live and you live and you live. And eventually you get to a point where you start thinking, I'm kind of old. Or you start feeling that stage in your life. This is a kind of a mysterious rite of passage to me. And I'm not sure how much of that is just that it's the one that I'm facing, and how much of it is that it really, it's so undefined in our society. We don't do anything except disappear our old people.
Yeah.
We have a cult of youth, and we just don't pay attention to people who are older. Except in very specialized circumstances like political power and corporate power. And in that case, it's almost exclusively older white men with a lot of money.
Yeah.
I feel that I will be missing an opportunity and kidding myself, which is the worst of those two sins, if I don't acknowledge at some point that I am no longer a spring chicken, that I'm no longer even halfway through my life. I am well beyond halfway through my life, and I am entering my twilight years. I think that there are great things about that time, because it's a cliche, but wisdom accumulates over time. It really does. And some people get a jump on it. I think you're one of them, Yucca. I think you've got a good start. You're going to be super wise by the time you're...
Well, that's kind of you to say.
I kind of banged my head against the wall for a long, long time. But I do feel like I have some things to say in the world. And I'm no longer ashamed to say them. And I don't feel that it's not my place to say them. And there is a particular kind of quality that happens in both men and women at a certain age where they just don't give a damn anymore. They're going to say what they're going to say, and they're going to tell you what they think. And that that is a different state than when you're 40. It just is. It's a different state. And so I feel like I want to do a rite of passage into elderhood. Now, when that should happen is kind of a big question. When I initially wrote about this on the blog, I thought, well, I'll do it when I'm 60. But I'm going to be 59 in January. And I'm not quite sure whether I'm there yet. I don't know whether I'm able to fully embrace that yet. There are a lot of pieces of it, that some of which are kind of sad. I mean, one of them is surrendering sexuality in many ways. And I'm just not sure whether I'm ready to do all that yet. But I know that it's a transition that I want to do, and I want to do it not only for myself, but as modeling for my pagan community around me. Because I think that that's an important, it's an important status to acknowledge people have arrived at, that one has become an elder, that is so much better of a story than, well, they rose into their power and then they disappeared, which it seems is what we do with our elderly in this society. And I don't think it's right. I think we need to be much more respectful of what age brings us. So that's my theory about it. What's your theory about it, speaking from the vantage of 30?
Well, in full honesty, it's not something that I've given a lot of thought to yet. It still feels a very long way away. And every now and then I'll get a little terrifying feeling of, whoa, I'm further through my life than I thought I was. But as you were speaking, I was listening and thinking a little bit about what we were just talking about with the teenager years, where we're talking about kind of that stepstone. Because one of the things I was thinking with the elder, again, coming from sort of the female, you know, biologically female side of, well, we do have the menopause, but that, you know, there's a big range of when that can happen. But in a lot of ways, I think that happens for many people before that transition into that you were talking about, that real elderhood stage of that place of wisdom and that place of, I don't give a damn. You know, there's a transition period between there.
There is, I agree. And I don't know exactly how to reconcile that either, because my experience of women in menopause is that, other than the hot flashes and emotional surges and all the, you know, sort of hormonal things that happen, there's a tremendous freedom for a while. And they're very, very sexual and very gregarious, many of them. And there's just this sort of, oh, well, I'm done with all that. Now I can actually go out and have some fun quality that I've really respected and appreciated. So, and of course, you know, this is just my little sample of people around me, so I'm not making a generalization about everybody. But it seems to me that that is almost sort of a last hurrah kind of thing before you arrive at the elderhood period, when you know that you're winding down and you're reflecting, and your reflections have value to those that are younger than you are. Hopefully.
So tying this into kind of a pagan framework, with the Wheel of the Year, for me, one of the things that observing it really helps to make stand out is that there aren't four seasons. There's a lot more than four seasons.
Yes.
And as we're going through talking about these different rites of passage, it seems to stand out to me that our childhood, adulthood, elderhood is, you know, woefully inadequate for what we're actually going through.
I think that's probably right, because the truth is that adulthood and elderhood, I mean, there's a 40-year gap there or more. And people do go through a significant series of phases between those. What I've seen in our culture is that people are so focused on careers and raising families that they just don't pay as much attention to themselves during the 30s and 40s. In the 50s, children start moving away, family becomes, the attention turns back inward a little bit more. And of course, I'm not speaking for myself because I don't have children.
You're just speaking of sort of a broad pattern that you recognize.
Yes, that I've seen in friends, and that seems to be what I'm observing, but I could be projecting it. So take it for what it's worth. There is this moment in the 50s and even maybe into the 60s where there's this sort of second liberation. The first liberation, you know, is adulthood, when you can finally do what you want without your parents telling you you can't. And now there's this other liberation where you can finally do what you want because your kids won't tell you that you can't. And that makes a lot of sense to me. People talk about the empty nest syndrome, and I'm sure that's really true. But if there were a rite of passage, a ceremonial experience that helped people to make that transition, maybe they wouldn't experience empty nest syndrome quite so much. Maybe they would become more comfortable with the new phase of their lives.
Yeah.
What would we call that? Early elderhood.
Well, it does really seem to mirror some of the teenage and young adulthood, mm-hmm. young elderhood. We don't have words to talk about it because it's something that our culture has really is uncomfortable with, because we're really uncomfortable
with aging
and what comes next.
Yes. So one more thing about passage into elderhood. I don't know exactly when it's going to be, but I have a very clear picture about what I want it to be like. And that is that I see it as a circle of people who are all of that age or older telling me what they've learned. You know, telling me, okay, on my long travels, here's what I've brought back. Because I think the distillation of knowledge and wisdom is something that old people have always done. And we've lost track of that. And I think getting back in that habit would be a good thing for them and for us. Mm-hmm. It would be good for the culture, and it would be good for those individuals, because that knowledge and wisdom has value and it's seen. So that's kind of what I'm hoping for. I'm fortunate in that my ritual circle is entirely older than I am. I am the kid. We are having our 30th Samhain this year, which is going to have to be virtual because of the COVID virus, which is just a shame. But 30 years. I can't believe it. Time flies fast. It really does. So let's talk about death.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right. Obviously, that's the last of the rites of passage. And
well, there's two sides to it, though. There's the individual dying, and there's those who didn't die.
There's right? the processing for the survivors.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And, how do I talk about this? I've done quite a lot of work on my own ideas about my death. I have a packet of documents with my advance directives, my will, my farewell letter, my obituary wishes, my body disposal wishes, all the passwords for my online accounts, everything that people would need if I were suddenly to drop dead as a gift to the people that I love. Because when you're grieving,
you don't want to deal with
it. You have to go digging through papers to try to find stuff. It makes no sense at all. You know, insurance documents and just all that kind of stuff. And what's included in there is about a half a page about how I would like to die. I mean, I want to be at home. And so I've written out, well, you know, here's the kind of environment that I like to be in. There are people called death doulas now, mm-hmm. who are actually, the work that they do is to create the environment that a dying person wants to be in. And I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
That's a longer ritual. It can last for weeks. But providing palliative care in a hospice kind of context and just being really kind conforming to the interest that the dying person has in what colors they like and what smells they like and what kind of music they'd like to listen to and all that kind of stuff, I think is really important.
Mm.
And then you can welcome your loved ones as your energy allows and say goodbye. And if I get to do that, I think it'll be a pretty beautiful way to die.
Mm-hmm. And it's tough to think about, but it's also, there's a lot of beauty in it.
Very much so. I'm in no hurry to leave. I'm happy to say I'm having a wonderful time and there's still quite a lot of stuff that I'd like to do. But that said, if I got a terminal diagnosis tomorrow and was told I had 2 weeks, I have a plan of how I'd like that to happen. I want to die at home. I'd like my funeral to be at home. I'd like my friends to take care of my body. I don't want some stranger to turn me into a toxic pickle. I have very decidedly political opinions about how death is done in this country. And I don't want to do it that way. So, as you say, that's kind of the first part of the process. So, I don't know whether you've thought about this at all yet. Do you have any thoughts about what that would be like for you?
Not specifics yet. I mean, I have paperwork in order of what should happen to our kids if, you know, we're both in a car accident at the same time or that sort of thing.
Sure.
And I would want my ashes spread on our land, which is what was done with my mother and, you know,
mm-hmm.
but beyond that, that's not something that I've spent a lot of time sitting with. I've had moments where not the details of what will happen, but the sitting with accepting that death will come,
mm-hmm.
right? One day, I will not be I anymore.
Yes. One day all this stops.
Yeah. And I find tremendous comfort in the shift of view of who I is for that.
Mm-hmm.
Where if I shift from seeing, you know, me, this human, to I am to the universe that is getting to experience itself as me right now, there's a lot more acceptance there. But that isn't quite the same as what we're talking about. That's more of the comfort with.
Right. That's the
mortality, right?
Coming to grips with the fact that we're going to die. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, by the way, one of the things about becoming a parent, which I was not prepared for, is how much that was going to, how much that gets rubbed in, the mortality thing gets rubbed in your face when you're like, you're watching your beautiful, wonderful children come into being, and it's, this all stops. I don't get to be that anymore. I'm never going to be that. I'm never going to be a baby again. I'm never going to be a toddler. I'm never going to go through that. I am in, and hopefully, they'll bury me one day.
Mm-hmm.
They will continue.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think this is actually something that when we get closer to Samhain, we should come back to this.
Again. I would like to. That's the time of year that I update my documents every year.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that I've got my death right up to date. And so I think that would be a great time for us to revisit this, and we can kind of walk people through some of the things that they can do and maybe dispel some illusions about what people think they're legally required to do.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, let's do that. Yeah. So we have now gone through the dying process and we are dead.
Yes.
One more rite of passage for the people that are still alive, and that is the memorial or the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And my orientation to that has always been that it should be a celebration of the person's life.
I share that as well, yeah.
Which is distinct from a celebration of the fact that they've gone to heaven, which is what I've seen in a lot of funerals and has really annoyed me. People that I know didn't have a religious bone in their bodies, you know, and someone who never knew them has been hired to stand at the front of the room and talk about Jesus. It's very irritating to me. It's rude.
I mean,
it's really kind of rude to the dead. So, of course, the thing to remember is that the memorial is for the living. And so you want it to be something to bring them good memories and to remind them of the character of the person who died. So you might want to put together a playlist of their favorite music,
mm-hmm.
and readings of poems that they liked or stories that they liked or retelling of a kind of crazy story about something outrageous that they did at some point. The idea is just for a moment to bring the person to life again in the minds of the people who will carry them forward in the only way that they will really continue to exist, which is as a memory.
Mm-hmm.
And that, folks, is the arc of life.
Yep.
There are opportunities for rites of passage from before birth to after death. And they can be done, some of them can be done solo, but it is so much more powerful to do them in the eyes of the community, in the eyes of the people around you that love you. Come together and say, hey, we're having a baby. Or, hey, this person is going to be a young adult. Or, hey, we have a relationship and it works. All of those moments.
Mm-hmm.
Because they become some of the most memorable moments of your life. When you do these observances, they become very special days. The same way that a wedding day is a very special day. All of them become very special days and moments to remember. So I highly commend this practice to you of seizing the day when the opportunity arises to make one of these transitions.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mark. This was This was great.
Yeah, I thought this was a good conversation. Thank you so much, Yucca. And we will see you coming up next week. Remember, you can reach us at the podcast, the one, let me try that again. The Wonder Podcast Cues at gmail.com. And we love hearing from you. So please do send us your comments and questions and suggested topics. In the meantime, everybody stay safe and healthy and loved, and enjoy this magnificent world.